You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
The world is constantly changing and transforming. Cut through some of the noise with What's New with Wired, a podcast that goes in depth on the latest news and technology and culture. Their award-winning journalism will help you make sense of what's happening in the world. Listen to What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts. That's What's New with Wired wherever you get your podcasts.
The corporate world is like the ocean. It's alluring, but it's also full of deadly creatures that can shred you to pieces.
It becomes kind of like a Game of Thrones political arena where everyone's trying to murder you to get your job.
My family doesn't come from corporate background, so I didn't have any sort of guidance in that.
This is not your typical work podcast.
Sometimes you need to be empathetic. And then there are times that you ask for input, but you don't really give a shit.
Listen to the Ambie Award-nominated podcast, Surfing Corporate.
Stretch opportunity. What is this, yoga class? Get out of here.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Before I start the show, I want to make two quick announcements. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be doing a listener survey to get a better idea of who's listening out there. No matter how long you've been a listener or how frequently you listen to the show, I'd like to get to know you better and to get a better idea of what you want. So it'll be an enormous help to me if you'll fill out a short questionnaire at kickasspolitics.com, or you can click on the survey link in the show notes to this episode. It'll only take 60 seconds, and you can even fill out the survey anonymously if you want. It's just a few quick questions, and it'll help me better tailor content and advertising for you, the listeners. And the other way you can help out in a very big way is by donating to our fundraising campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics, or click on the donate button on our webpage. I'm ramping up to 2 shows a week now, and I've set an ambitious goal of funding all of our production costs for the coming year by the end of this month. It's a chance for you to participate in what I'm creating here, and there'll be some cool rewards for donating and chances for you to interact with me and the show. Plus, you'll get a thank you shout out on the podcast. So if you want to have amazingly good karma like Stan Kerr, Brent Smith, Ken Molan, and Karen Vanek, then help me reach our goal by the end of the month and click on the donate link at kickasspolitics.com or go to gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. That's enough begging for now. Enjoy the show. Welcome to Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. 8 years as a journalist for the Chicago Tribune, 40 years as a political strategist, 150 campaigns. His client list has included Senators Paul Simon, John Edwards, Chris Dodd, Governors Andrew Cuomo, Deval Patrick, Tom Vilsack, and the Clintons. But he's best known as the political genius behind President Barack Obama's victory in 2008 and 2012. I'm, of course, talking about David Axelrod. After a long career as the go-to strategist for Democrats running for office, Axelrod served 3 years as senior advisor to the president and then got back in the game one last time to help deliver his longtime friend back to the White House in 2012. Since then, he's written his autobiography titled Believer. He started the University of Chicago's Institute of Politics, where he currently serves as director. And just recently, David Axelrod launched his own podcast called The Axe Files. Today, he'll talk about his very first campaign, his early days covering notorious Chicago politics for the Tribune, his 23-year friendship with Barack Obama, and his lifelong love for the political process. Plus, we'll discuss the president's health care act, the president's relationship with Israel, and at least one reason why he says Donald Trump isn't so bad. All that and more with David Axelrod coming up in just a moment.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Today I'm joined by Democrat campaign strategist, the brains behind the Obama victory in 08 and 12, and former senior advisor to the president, now retired, at least from politics, David Axelrod. David, thanks for coming on the show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I see that you've lost the mustache. When did that happen?
That happened right after the 2012 election. During the final weeks of the election, I was on Morning Joe, and Joe Scarborough had been fed some deficient polls by the Republicans, and he said, "You guys are in trouble in Pennsylvania, in Michigan, in Minnesota." I said, "Joe, if we lose any of those states, I will shave off my mustache of 40 years." And he said, and I said, "But if we win them all, then you have to grow one." So he said, "Well, let me just amend the bet. If you win those states plus Florida, I will grow a mustache." So we did.
Order.
We did. I got a call from Joe the next day saying, "Look, I can't grow a mustache. So I'm going to give you $10,000 for your epilepsy foundation. I have a child with epilepsy. It's been a defining struggle in my life. My wife started an organization called Citizens United for Research in Epilepsy." I went home to my wife. I said, "What about it?" She said, "That's not enough." She said, "You go back and tell him you'll still shave off your mustache if we can raise $1 million for cure by the end of November."
Wow.
So we started this drive called Slash the Stash. We ended up raising $1.2 million. By the way, one of our largest donors, Donald J. Trump. I went to Mark Cuban and I said, "You can't let Trump outdo you." And he gave me more than Trump. And so I ended up shaving my mustache off on national TV. I got 10 steps away from doing it. And my wife Susan said to me, "I always hated that thing anyway." I said, "We've been married 33 years." And she said, "I didn't think you'd do anything bad, but now that it's off, leave it off." So that's it. Mustache is gone.
Yeah, you know, I think every growing or shaving facial hair always seems to come from a bet one way or another. So does this mean that you're endorsing Trump?
No, but I do. I'm grateful for his generosity, and I feel like I should say it every once in a while because it was a great thing to do.
I hate to ambush you like this, but you and I have actually met.
How do you generally ambush people?
Well, I'm pretty, that's true. Politely ambush you.
I hate to ambush you like this. This is how I usually ambush
you. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But when did we meet?
We met, I think it was probably about 3 or 4 years ago at the Langham Hotel in Pasadena, California. And you were there with the actor from West Wing. I forget what his name was. And I forget why you were there. But I sent over, I was there with friends, and I sent over drinks or dessert or something over to you. And at the time, I think it was around the time of the election, I said, just to show that all Republicans aren't so bad.
Really?
But
you must feel lonely sometimes.
At that election I did. Yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah. No, I do remember that now, but I didn't associate that with you. If I had known that, I would have brought a bottle of wine or something.
That would have been nice. We probably would have gotten some really interesting stuff out of you today then. But yeah, but you were so nice. And I remember, you know, you said, "Are you working on any campaigns right now?" Because I've done a good deal of media work here and there. I was helping out Rick Perry, because I'm from Texas. It's a Texas thing. And I remember you said, "How's that working out for you?" With kind of a grin on your face.
Yeah. So, yeah. But you know what? I also want to say, I honor anybody in the arena. My whole shtick is, my fundamental belief is that politics ultimately is a really honorable calling. And I admire people who are in the arena. I now run an Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. And the mission really is to bring people from across the political spectrum, practitioners, who can help inspire these young people to understand that there is worth in politics. And it's a tough battle, you know, today. There's so many bad examples and so much reason for skepticism. And yet, this is, in a democracy, how we turn the wheel of history. And there's nothing more invigorating than being in the middle of that process.
Well, yeah, and you came out with your autobiography earlier in the year, and the title of it's Believer.
Yes.
Which is interesting, because I think so many people have this very cynical view of political strategists and so forth, that they're just in it for the love of the game. And you're different. You really care about
the— I do. I mean, I love the game
ideology
too, and
behind—
I think,
it.
Like I said, it's such an incredibly invigorating process. There's so many interesting people in it. They're all gathered around this Politicon now, which makes it a nice event. But, you know, I wanted the subtitle of my book to be How My Idealism Survived 40 Years in Politics. And the publisher said, oh, that's too many words for the cover. But that's really what the book is about. You know, I have no illusions about some of the pitfalls of politics, some of the compromises that one has to make. I've made compromises in terms of some of the people that I've worked for who ended up disappointing me. Some have surprised me on the upside. But by and large, I've also worked for a bunch of folks who have made a real difference in their states and in their communities. And ultimately, I work for a president of the United States in whom I believe. And I've seen tangible progress come because of the election of these people. So I really do believe in this process. I think it's important. And the thing is, you know, I say to these young kids who I think this is the most public-spirited group of young people I've seen since I was a kid in the 60s. But they're very skeptical that politics is the way to change the world. So you talk about a problem, they say, well, let's create an app. You know, let's do social media. And that is very, very powerful stuff. But it's not a substitute for governing. And I tell them all the time, you know, all the equities you care about, whatever they are, they're going to make decisions in the Congress, in legislatures, that are going to profoundly impact the things you care about. You can avert your eyes and walk away, or you can become part of the process and try and influence it in the way you think is appropriate. And I really do believe in that.
I have to ask then, how do you keep your faith? How do you keep your optimism? Because, you know, you cut your teeth in Chicago politics. There are undoubtedly some candidates that disappointed you. You believed in that
some
let you down.
Some were
like
sitting
Lago.
In penitentiaries.
Yeah, or what was it? John Edwards was another client of yours. Right. How do you get past that? How do you keep your optimism in this field?
Well, because for all of those, there are many more I work for who made a huge difference. You know, I work for Deval Patrick in Massachusetts. I saw him bring about really positive change in terms of strengthening the education system. They're bringing biotechnology on alternative energy. You know, and I worked for a president who I think is, you know, people may have different views of the change he's brought, but he's brought significant changes. You know, one of them obviously was in our healthcare system. And as I mentioned earlier, I have a child who's had a chronic illness since she was 7 months old. And I was one of the Americans who almost went bankrupt in this system, even though I had insurance because it didn't cover her medication. It was $1,000 a month out of pocket, and I was making $38,000 a year as a reporter. Having said that, I was very nervous about the president taking this on because I was his political advisor. Seven presidents had tried it. Seven presidents had failed. I was very, very familiar with the polling on this issue, very frightened by it because I knew it was going to be a difficult fight. And, you know, he said, well, what are we supposed to do? Put our approval rating on the shelf and admire it for 8 years? Are we supposed to draw down on it to try and do something for the country? And I loved him for that, even as he was overruling my advice. I always say I like him so much because he listened to me so little. And he drove us through this process. And every time it looked like health reform was going to die, he pushed us forward. I walked into his office and the summer of 2009 with some polling data that was very discouraging. And we were taking on water on this issue. And he said, you know, I'm sure that's right, but I just got back from Green Bay and I met a woman who was 36 years old. She had two children. She and her husband both have jobs and insurance. And now she has stage 4 breast cancer and she's worried about, she's hitting up on her lifetime caps. And she's worried about dying and leaving her family bankrupt. And he said, so, you know, let's just keep fighting. And, Ben, I have to tell you that that following March, when improbably the thing did pass, we were standing in the Oval Office, not in the Oval Office, in the Roosevelt Room, president, vice president, everybody who worked on the issue. We were watching the final votes come in. My office was right next to his, and I got up, and I went into my office, and I closed the door. And I just bawled. I sobbed. And I didn't even know why at first. And I realized it was because I knew that because of what he had done and what we had done to help him, there were other families that wouldn't go through what we went through. And I was so grateful for that and to be a part of it. I went and I found him and I said, I want to thank you on behalf of all the families who won't have to go through what mine did. And he's a great friend, so he knew what my family had been through. And he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, well, that's why we do the work. And that's what I believe about politics. That's so, you know, you have moments
so
like that.
So healthcare was personal to you.
Very
this
much
whole
so.
Thing was
it was
personal,
even as I understood the political peril of it, and my job called on me to tell him what the political peril would be. But not just personal to me, but all the people walk up to me on the street, the young man who got health care through the Affordable Care Act and didn't feel well but hadn't gone to the doctor until he got his insurance, found out he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, had tears in his eyes, said, "I think you guys saved my life." How do you put a price on that? How do you not be inspired by those kind of interchanges?
The rollout of the Affordable Care Act had some hiccups.
I would say you are being very, very polite. Yeah. I mean, they were a disaster. I mentioned I started a podcast myself called The Axe Files, and I had on there the other day Anish Chopra, who was our first chief technology officer and was deeply involved in the run-up to that but was gone by the time the rollout came. And I asked him, you know, because I felt like I was gut-punched. Yeah. When that computer failed, when that system failed, when people couldn't get through, I felt for all the hard work that everyone had done, what a nightmare that was. And he too said, you know, how he was heartbroken by it, and it was completely unnecessary. They brought a SWAT team in, and within a matter of months, and for a fraction of the money they spent on the system, they were able to get the thing working. So,
okay. Was there anything that you would have done different looking back?
Well, you know, there are probably many things that, if you in a perfect world, you'd like to do differently. We shepherded that law through a very sloppy track, very difficult political system. You know, there was a lot of pressure. You know, there were Republicans who had supported a similar proposal in the 90s who were still in the Senate who said to us, you know, a lot of pressure. Unless you can get like 10 Republicans, I'm not going to stand by myself on this. We would have loved it to be a bipartisan effort. At one point, Olympia Snow was talking to us, the former senator from Maine. She was in the Senate
Republican.
At the time, Republican. And she had some changes she wanted to make, and the president said, "I'm fine." He said, "Hell, I'll call it the Snow Bill. I don't mind." He said she can move into the White House. He said, "Michelle and I'll get an apartment." So we really wanted that. And you know, we obviously cut deals, as you do in the legislative process, that were less than optimal, and became issues. You know, our discussions with Ben Nelson from Nebraska was one that got publicized. I think the redemption of the Affordable Care Act actually came in the months before the vote, when the president had the session in the Blair House, where everybody sat around the table, Republicans and Democrats, with C-SPAN in tow, and said and spoke their minds, and the American people could hear the full debate. I thought that was actually one of the highlights of my time in Washington, to see the president and these earnestly talking about the possibilities, the concerns, and so on. But I wish we had done more of that.
Yeah. Well, let's go back a little bit farther, back to the beginning here, because your book, which I highly recommend to anyone left or right who's going into politics, one of the things that you point out is, you know, my life didn't begin with Barack Obama.
That's
my
one
life
didn't write
as a
the book. Yeah.
Yeah, it didn't begin in 08.
Yes.
You know, you had a long career in politics.
Yes.
And you actually began your career as a journalist for the Chicago Tribune covering the City Hall. And 7 years into that career path, you decided to go over to the enemy, so to speak, and join the campaign of Paul Simon. Why 7 years on that into that track did you suddenly
have a change
of career?
Well, I did. First of all, I got into journalism in part because of my interest in politics. You know, my interest in politics was really fired by a visit by John F. Kennedy to the housing development where I grew up in New York, Stuyvesant Town, when I was 5 years old. And it just seemed so important and so exciting and so interesting that I got sucked in and started working on campaigns as a kid. And I went to the University of Chicago because I thought Chicago's a really interesting political town, last of the big city
that's
machine.
To say the
they
least.
Had the Democratic Convention there in 1968 that was calamitous and historic. They had a budding black independent political movement. I thought, man, this would be really interesting to study. And then I got to the University of Chicago, and the University of Chicago at that time was very insular and monastic, and I couldn't find anybody who wanted to talk about anything that happened after the year 1800. So I started writing for newspapers so I could write about politics. And I was lucky enough to get a job at the Chicago Tribune when I graduated. I quickly became, after a couple of years on nights, I got a chance to be a political writer. And I loved it. It was the greatest education you could have. But I could see that the industry was changing. Newspapers were changing. There was new management at the Tribune after about 6 years, very much more bottom line oriented. The whole environment kind of changed. And I thought, I love journalism so much, I want to do it the way I was trained to do it, the way I believe in it. And if I can't, maybe I should look at other things. And about that time, Paul Simon came along, who was this very, very good guy. He was a congressman from Southern Illinois. He was kind of the Orville Redenbacher of Illinois politics.
Bow tie.
Bow tie, yeah. And horn-rimmed glasses, you know, ill-fitting suits that were bequeathed to him by a constituent that he just never got altered. He was a guy who fought. He was from deep Southern Illinois, closer to Little Rock than Chicago. He fought for civil rights in the Illinois legislature, which was very hard from his district. He was a reformer, which was very hard from any district in Illinois. And he was a man of principle who believed. He was the ultimate believer. And I thought if ever I was going to go into politics, this was the kind of guy I wanted to associate myself with. And so he was running against Chuck Percy, who was a three-term incumbent senator in what was going to be a major national race. And he asked me to come to work for him. And that was really changed my life, changed the direction of my life.
Well, were there any lessons that you learned on that first campaign that have served you well throughout your political career?
I think you learn something on every campaign that that serves you well. But my instinct has always been that conventional wisdom is almost always wrong, and don't think conventionally. And we got to the end of what was an incredibly brutal campaign. Remember, Ronald Reagan was running for re-election at the time,
yeah,
swept Illinois by a landslide. So we had this tied, and yet Simon was very competitive, but it was a brutal race, back and forth, back and forth. We got to the final debate, and Simon was—he had felt that Percy had been sort of bullying him in previous debates, and he was intent on giving back as much as he got. And they just pounded each other at one point. They both had hearing impairment, and Simon said, "Chuck, if you turn up your hearing aid, I'll turn up mine." And it was just an unbelievable bloodbath. And, Simon's hallmark was decency, and his numbers plummeted. And we were in trouble in that race in the last 2.5 weeks. By now, I was the campaign manager through a series of events that are too ridiculous
to
recount.
That's a quick ascendancy.
Yeah, it is. Talk about a baptism of fire. Yeah. Now, I had a lot of helpers. David Wilhelm, who ended up being the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, managed the Clinton campaign, was my executive director. Forrest Claypool, who became a prominent public administrator and politician in Illinois, was my one of my deputies. Rahm Emanuel was a field and fundraising guy. It was quite a great young crew. But anyway, we got to this juncture, and the advice of the consultant we had, and we had a very fine one, Bob Squire, kind of a legend in political consulting, was we got to just eviscerate this guy with negative ads. And I was a 29-year-old kid who had never run a campaign before, and I said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to put an ad up in which Paul talks about why he's running. And our whole predicate was that Percy had shifted on a lot of issues in order to satisfy the right wing. He was quite a moderate when he came up in politics. And he had seen a number of his colleagues lose: Jacob Javits, Clifford Case, sort of icons of liberal and moderate republicanism. So he shifted before this election, and people were really leery of that. And we did an ad in which Paul talked about his principles, and it was very much a liberal pro-government thing in the Reagan year. Mm-hmm. And he said, "My opponent calls me old-fashioned, but I don't mind. I'd rather lose with principle than win by standing for nothing. I want to be a senator you can count on." That's how the ad ended. And we came back behind that ad because It was honest and it was authentic and it was what people wanted. And you know what? We won 25% of the self-described conservatives in that race. They didn't agree with Paul Simon, but they admired him for the principled man he was.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like to some extent you kind of embraced a little bit of the Reagan mystique, a liberal version of Ronald Reagan in that the folksiness and the authenticity and so forth.
Ronald Reagan, a native of Illinois, by the way.
Yeah,
of Illinois. And those Midwestern virtues actually served Reagan throughout his life.
Yeah. We're going to take a quick break now, and then when I come back, we'll talk about the 2016 election and some of the lessons that David Axelrod learned over his 40-year career in politics. Back in just a moment. If you're enjoying my conversation with David Axelrod, then check out his autobiography. It's called Believer, My 40 Years in Politics. And right now, you can download the audio version of Believer for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be Believer by my guest today, David Axelrod, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And if you like Kick-Ass Politics, then help us reach our goal of funding the next year of programming by the end of this month. Make a donation at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics or go on our website at kickasspolitics.com and click the donate button. And now, back to more with my guest today, David Axelrod. We're back, and I'm talking with political strategist and former senior advisor to President Barack Obama, David Axelrod. 2008.
Yes.
And you had a tough decision to make. You said you contemplated taking a break from politics before the 08 campaign because you had five candidates who had been clients of yours. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, Chris Dodd, and Tom Vilsack were all past clients. That's a lot of hearts to break.
Well, I don't want to overstate my own importance, but it was, but I, you know, I liked them all, but I, and not every one of them, you know, Edwards and I had kind of a difficult relationship when he ran for president, so he wasn't going to ask me to work for him.
So did his wife.
Yes. Well, and I had a difficult relationship with her, but I didn't want to choose, and I thought actually it would be fun to kind of write about the election and comment on the election, which is what I'm doing now in 2016. And it was really, I thought I was sort of at the end of my career in political consulting. I was thinking about making a move into documentary, producing documentaries. And I thought this would be a good transition. And I said to everyone, the only thing that would change my mind is if Barack decided to run for president, because I so deeply believed in him and believed that he was the kind of leader the country needed that I could not have sat that out. I also had the kind of relationship with him, and I had learned in previous presidential campaigns that if you don't have a close, trusting relationship with the principal, you're not going to be effective, because there are so many times when that relationship is tested in a presidential race. And I knew I had that relationship with Obama. And so when he, and it was honestly a big surprise to me when it all evolved into a race. I really was convinced. In the summer of 2006, I told Patty Solis Doyle, who was then Hillary Clinton's manager and had come to ask me if I would work with him, that I wasn't going to be involved unless Barack had it. And I told her, and I really don't believe he's going to. And I was absolutely sincere about that. But events kind of just, I mean, and there's no doubt we threw some logs on that fire, but not with the expectation that he would be a candidate in 2008.
That's interesting. So were you, like a lot of people, somewhat sold on the inevitability of Hillary Clinton at that stage in the race?
I didn't know about that, although I thought that it was that she was a formidable candidate for sure. I just didn't my concern about Obama, and I told him this when we had a kind of we had this very intense conversation when on the January 2nd of 2007. He had all but made up his mind, and he came into my office to do sort of a gut check. Just walked in unexpectedly, you know, with his jeans and jacket and his head. He had a Sox cap on. It was like half my office didn't realize he was even there. And I said to him, you know, my concern about you is that you may be too normal to run for president. I mean, you're not pathological. I said, I know some of these other folks, they will drag themselves out of bed at 4 in the morning because they have to be president of the United States. I don't sense that about you. And I said, you know, you kind of like to hang with your friends and play ball, and you love your family, and you like spending time with them. And he said, you know, you're right. I don't feel like I have to be president, and I'm not that way. And I do like to watch the ESPN with my friends. But he said, if you're going to be in public life, you should try to do it at the highest possible level where you can have the biggest impact. And he said, if I run, he said, I will be, I'm very competitive, as you know, and I certainly knew that. And I will do what I need to do. But it took him, you know, like 6 months before he really became a good candidate. He was not a good candidate for, and he was not a happy candidate for a long time. Missed his family. There was one time we were flying in a plane. Robert Gibbs, his press secretary, was opposite him. Reggie Love, his body man, was right next to him. Young guy went everywhere with him. Robert said to Obama, boss, are you having any fun at all? And Obama said, nah, not really. And Reggie listened to all this, and he kind of poked Obama and Barack. So what, Reggie? And Reggie said, I don't know if this makes you feel any better, but I'm having the time of my life. But it was a rough introduction to presidential politics, but he did challenge himself. He said at one point, I'm not a good candidate now, and I know it. He said, but I will be. He said, I'm going to make myself a good candidate. And he did.
Because I don't think that most people even remember that there was that bumpy period for him. I think that everyone
just to put it in perspective, in October of 2007, there were meetings called by donors with Obama demanding that he fire me, fire Plouffe. They said the strategy's all wrong. You've got to bring in some of the smart Washington guys. And because we were like 30 points behind Hillary Clinton in national polls, but we weren't playing the national poll game. We invested everything in Iowa, 83 days in Iowa in 2007, tons of resources into Iowa because we knew the only way we were going to win the nomination is if we won the Iowa caucuses, and we put everything into it.
A candidate like Marco Rubio gets criticized because he doesn't spend a lot of time in Iowa so far. So
I think it's less important.
Is it an antiquated
notion? I think it's less important in the Republican process than it is in the Democratic process.
Okay.
Because the Republican process is so thoroughly dominated by social conservatives that, you know, you look at the people who've won it, Huckabee, Rick Santorum the last time, you know, Pat Robertson did well there. I mean, that's the nature of the electorate that participates in the Republican caucuses there, and rarely do they produce the winner. That's not been true in the on the Democratic side, it has more meaning. So I think the Iowa caucuses are important. Let me just say a word for both Iowa and New Hampshire to the rest of the country. You know, we're sitting in California as we speak, which I'm sure is a state filled with people contemptuous of the power that these tiny little state homogenous states have. But it is the only place in the presidential process where candidates actually have to interact in the way that candidates for other offices do with real people, answer their questions, have real conversations. One of my favorite stories of the Iowa caucuses was we were flying somewhere, and Robert Gibbs said to the president, you know, the field guys say there's this 17-year-old high school kid, because you could vote in the caucuses if you're eligible to vote in the general election. You could participate in the caucuses. He said, there's a 17-year-old girl in this small town, they said, who could unlock 12 caucus votes for us if she were with us. And they want you to call her. And he says, okay. So he calls this 17-year-old girl, and I'm hearing only his end of the conversation. He says, hey, this is Barack Obama. How you doing? Want to talk to you about the race. And the next thing we heard was, no, that's, yeah, sure, okay, yeah, bye. And he hands the phone back to Gibbs. He said, well, what happened? He said, she said she had to go into class and could I call back later? And he said, man, this running for president is a humbling business.
Yeah.
But there's also a charm to that.
Yeah.
The fact that you have to one by one assemble your vote and really earn it.
Yeah.
And when I was a young reporter, I covered Reuben Askew. I don't know if you remember him. He probably predates you. But he was the governor of Florida, and he was one. You know, every election there are people who improbably run for president.
Yeah.
Jim Gilmore.
Okay.
So I went to a school with Reuben Askew, and Reuben gave a speech, Governor Askew gave a speech, and I went up to a 15-year-old kid. I said, well, what did you think about Governor Askew? Very impressive, the kid said. I said, well, if you could vote, would you vote for him? And the kid was like appalled. He said, I haven't met all the candidates yet. I haven't met them. So there's certain charm. And, Mo Udall used to tell that great, it may have been apocryphal, but it was a great, it bears repeating about walking into the barber shop and saying, I'm Mo Udall, I'm running for president in New Hampshire. And the barber said, yeah, I know, we were just laughing about that.
Yeah, campaigning in Iowa, I imagine, will cut you down to size pretty quickly if you have any kind of a political ego.
Yeah.
Well,
and that's good because these guys need to be cut down to size.
Yeah, so some of them do, absolutely. Well, as I said earlier, you had five candidates who you had worked with, four of whom you had to say no to. One of them was Hillary. And you had a good working relationship with her for many years and a personal friendship because she'd been very supportive of your wife's wonderful epilepsy foundation.
Absolute patron saint of cure, yeah.
Yeah, so that has to have been hard. And definitely that Democrat primary that year got pretty ugly. At the end of the campaign, you then went and did your best to pay homage and respect to Hillary Clinton after the election, after all of that had gone on. Was that the most awkward moment of your life?
Well, it felt less awkward to me than it apparently did to her, because I heard later that she told somebody that it felt like throwing up after the conversation. I didn't feel like throwing up after the conversation, but then we won. So,
yeah.
But it was, it's a hard thing to explain to somebody that it really wasn't personal, that it really was about what I thought was the person who was best suited for the country at that moment. But I don't blame her. I mean, look, I suspect that there are lingering feelings that will never totally disappear as a result of that. But I've no doubt I made the right decision.
Well, clearly the elections proved that. So, once the election was over, for the first time in your life, you move out to Washington. You, in your book, you say governing is always more difficult than campaigning. You've always been really a campaign guy.
Yeah.
Did you have to adjust your thinking when you moved into the West Wing and became advisor?
It was a total adjustment, and I was frightened about it. I'd spent a career staying out of Washington. I have a lot of great friends in Washington. I revere the institutions. I'm proud particularly as the son of an immigrant, I'm proud of America's institutions, and I think we sometimes take them for granted too much. But there's a pathology to Washington that it's who's up and who's down, and very bright, insecure people trying to kneecap each other, keeping the other guy out of the meeting to elevate their own importance, and so I knew all that, and I actually had this interesting conversation with Obama. After the election, or it was probably in the final weeks of the election when we were thinking about, we knew we were going to win. And I said, I don't know if I can go. And he said, why not? And he said, well, first of all, I said, I've spent my whole life setting myself up so I could tell anybody I wanted to go fuck themselves. And I've walked out of campaigns and work situations when I thought that it wasn't right. And I said, you can't say that to the president of the United States. And he said, well, that's probably true. You can't really say that to the president. He said, but, and then he made the case for why it was important, and so on and so forth. And at the end of it, he said, and one other thing I said was, I said, you can tell me to fuck myself, just don't do it in front of anybody else. So I went.
Well, that's good, because a president or a candidate, anyone needs to hear these things. They need to have someone who can be perfectly honest with them.
Absolutely essential. Absolutely essential. And that's the role I tried to play in the 2 years that I was there. And they were a hard 2 years. I went knowing that I was only going for 2 years. Couldn't do more than two because my family couldn't move because of my daughter's situation. And also because I knew that we were going to have a disastrous midterm election under any circumstance, because we had just had two bumper crops. We were holding all these seats that really weren't Democratic seats. It was clear we were going to go through the worst recession since the Great Depression, and it wasn't going to be abated by the midterm election. So I knew we were sailing into a storm, and that, you know, as the political guy, you're going to be blamed for that. I knew all of that, but I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. I got a chance to be there during a very historic period when we dealt with this extraordinary crisis and two wars and myriad other challenges, and did some important things like health reform. So it was I always say it's the best job I'll ever have, and I'd never do it again.
Well, looking back at those 4 years in the West Wing, what was your biggest disappointment about your time in Washington?
I think my biggest disappointment is that we really weren't able to change the tenor of politics in Washington. In fact, if anything, it got worse, because I think the Republican leadership made a judgment very early that we had huge majorities, we were in the middle of really difficult decisions, and they were going to let us wrestle with them, because that was the smartest and shrewdest way to get some of their to get their seats back and to get back onto equilibrium. And I regret that decision. I don't think it was the best decision for the country, but I understand the strategy behind it.
But you're Jewish. Your father fled the pogroms, the pogroms in Russia, from the Cossacks and so forth. And you said that you encountered a lot of Jews in the Democrat Party who said, yeah, we know what Obama says about Israel, but does he feel it in his kishkas?
Yeah.
Now, after the Iran deal and tense relationship with Bibi Netanyahu, do you still think that the president feels it in his kishkas?
Oh, absolutely I do. Look, let's be clear. Israel is not Bibi Netanyahu. Bibi Netanyahu is the leader of Israel right now. Israel isn't defined by Bibi Netanyahu. Israel, we have a special relationship with Israel that the president strongly believes, and not just because they're the only strong democracy in the region, but it goes deeper than that to the roots of Israel, why it was founded, what it represents. So I have no doubt that he feels it. Where there's a difference is sort of what the way forward is here, and how do you deal with all of the changes and all of the challenges of today, demographic changes, and maintain Israel as a democratic Jewish state, secure within its borders. And that's an ongoing discussion. As for Iran, you know, the question wasn't whether Iran should get a bomb or not. They plainly should not. The question is, what is the best way to stop them? And you know, he believed, and I believe as well, that the route he took held out the best possibility to stop it. If that deal had crashed, they would have resumed their program. They were only a few months away from obtaining the bomb or developing the bomb, and they would have gotten, and the sanctions would have fallen apart, and they would have gotten a windfall and made no sacrifices for it. So I'm proud of him for pushing forward on it. I think it was the right thing, and history will judge.
Well, I know that you have to go pretty soon here, so just a couple rapid fire quick ones here. Let's just clear this up right now. Obama, U.S. citizen?
Yes.
The president is a U.S. citizen.
I'm 100% certain of that.
Okay. Is he a Muslim?
He is a Christian, and I know what his relationship with Christianity has meant to him.
And your favorite disparaging name of all the disparaging names that Republicans have given you, liberal lumberjack or Axel Fraud?
Yeah, Axel Fraud was my favorite. That was one that one of the miscalculations we made in 2012 was they sent me up to Massachusetts to stand on the steps of the Capitol and speak disparagingly of Governor Romney's record as governor, and nobody calculated the fact that his national headquarters was two blocks away. So the crowd was less than friendly, they were holding up signs saying, you know, tell the truth, Axel Fraud, and so on. It was kind of fun, but not very useful.
Yeah. Well, you know, as a Republican, I'm here to vouch for you officially. David Axelrod is actually a really nice guy.
Thank
You're
you.
A great father. You and your wife have done a lot for epilepsy.
Thanks,
you're helping to teach others who want to go into the field now at the University of Chicago at your Institute for Politics, doing wonderful work out there.
Thank you.
And everyone should check out your new podcast, The Axe Files.
Thank you.
David Axelrod,
thank you. Great to be with you, and I owe you a drink.
Oh, well, one day.
Okay.
I'll take you up on it.
Great. Ben.
Thanks so
Thank
much,
you.
David. I want to thank David Axelrod again for coming on the podcast. I meant what I said. He's a really nice guy. And it's proof that, as William F. Buckley Jr. once said, we can disagree without being disagreeable. If you enjoyed our conversation, then go check out his new podcast. It's called The Axe Files, and it's available on iTunes. And I highly recommend his book, Believer. If you're a political junkie like me, it's a really, really interesting read. I'll include an Amazon link in the show notes and on the website. Or if you prefer, you can download the audio version of Believer for free with that special offer for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics or click on the sponsor link on our webpage at kickasspolitics.com to get your free 30-day trial and your free audio book. I also want to thank the folks at Politicon for arranging recording space for this interview during their big event at the LA Convention Center this past weekend. This was the first Politicon. It's basically Comic-Con for politics is the whole idea behind it, and it was a lot of fun. So hopefully they'll do it again next year, and if they do, then you should definitely check it out. They had some great guests, and it was a lot of fun. Now be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and leave us a review. And if you like the show, then please consider supporting Kick-Ass Politics by making a donation on the website or go to GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. We're doing two shows a week now, and I need your help to reach our goal of funding the entire production budget for 2016 by the end of this month. So I really hope you'll get involved and invest in what we're doing here. There'll also be some fun rewards for participants. So again, you can donate on our website, or you can go to GoFundMe.com/KickAssPolitics. You can keep up with the show on our Facebook page or follow us on Twitter at KAPolitics. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, gripes, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. In the next episode, just in time for Steven Spielberg's new movie, Bridge of Spies, my guest will be Dr. Vince Houghton. He's historian and curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and he's the host of the incredibly popular and interesting podcast called Spycast. We'll talk about the true story behind the Bridge of Spies, Cold War espionage, America's spy history from the Revolution to the CIA, plus the greatest spy that ever lived, and the coolest spy gadgets he's got at the International Spy Museum. All coming up in the next episode. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.